I'm watching a YouTube clip from a 1989 movie called Zombie Rampage. The grainy black and white footage shows a bunch of lumbering guys in sweatshirts and jeans crowding around a skinny dude on a darkened city street. They're groaning and pummeling him. If I had to guess, the ones moaning and groaning and pummeling and such are zombies, and the dude in the sneakers is a regular person. This is the first of many movies by Todd Sheets, a Kansas City filmmaker who earned a cult following for his horror movies during the 1980s home video era. He was dubbed the Prince of Gore. After a long hiatus and quadruple bypass surgery, he's back with a new movie premiering here in town tomorrow night. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Todd, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Great to be here.
Awesome. So what was going on in that movie I just sampled?
None of that matters because no one should ever watch that movie.
Why not?
It's god-awful. My first movie, you know, we started in 88 here in Kansas City. I was pretty young, and it was the first of many films. You know, the anything I made before 93, I kind of disowned because...
Really?
Well, you know, it's hard to explain, but when I caught a lot of heat for those early movies because I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, I was pretty much a kid, and I was doing the best I could. And there was a lot of us that believed in what we were doing, and we worked really hard. And that part of it I love. Everyone has to start somewhere, right?
Yeah. When people criticized the movies, what were they saying?
Pretty much they were junk. And they were pretty right in a lot of ways. But there was a lot of, you know, some raw talent on display, I think, from other, you know, area artists and actors and actresses and things that, you know, we were all working really hard, trying our best at the time. And since you really don't know what you're doing, you're kind of learning by doing it. And the films went out worldwide and ended up being successful, but I can't live them down. I want them to go away, but now they're everywhere.
When you look back at those movies, which it sounds like you don't totally love doing, like you said, everyone has to start somewhere. And a lot of times when you go back to the sort of rougher early work, even through all of the sort of, unpolished edges, you can see a nugget of something that really does come to shine later on. Do you see that?
I do see a little of what we were trying to do and how we finally got it right after years of practice. But, you know, it was very difficult because in Kansas City, some people saw those movies. And now worldwide, I never had a problem. Everyone understood. But locally, I had a problem because people would see those movies and they were like, oh, man, this guy stinks. And for some reason, they would never give you a second chance. It's like
you have a reputation in town.
Well, the thing was, you know, 10 years later, people were still giving me a hard time about these early movies. And I'm like, well, you haven't seen one of my movies in 10 or 15 years and you're still saying I'm a trash filmmaker or a schlock or whatever. I'm like, well, why don't you give it a chance? I mean, since then we've won a lot of awards and we've learned a lot. And I'd been an intern on many, many films and I'd even worked on, like, you know, with Romero and Child's Play 3. And I'd David DeCoto from Hollywood had taken me in as a mentor. And I was learning every day. So I guess that's the problem I had was I'm working really hard to become a better filmmaker. And it's terrible that my own hometown was treating me like a martyr.
Well, when you talked about that you've disowned everything you made since 1990 or before 1993.
Yes, ma'am.
So what happened 1993? That's when your big movie came out, Zombie Bloodbath.
Yeah, that's true. That was the first time I really put a lot of effort, because before that was mostly friends and we were just having a good time being dorks, you know, running around with cameras and doing our thing. It was Zombie Bloodbath. I had a lot of local support and I had a lot of press. I was even on Jon Stewart's show at the time. And
what was different about that movie?
I think it was the fact that we were really making an effort to really make a movie for the first time. And of course, as it would happen, the first time we try to take an effort and do something really cool, we're involved in the biggest flood in the Midwest probably ever. And I know there was one in the 50s. I think the one in the 90s was even worse. A lot of our locations was underwater, and we would go to film there, and we couldn't because the building was submerged except for maybe the top floor. It was insane. And I remember we would be filming at Park College, and we would stop filming at 3 or 4 in the morning, and take a load of zombies and go down to the river and sandbag the river to try to keep the town from flooding, to help the town.
So you were doing flood relief while making a zombie
while
movie?
While making a zombie movie, which kind of caught the attention of national media, which was kind of fun. And they came in, and we saw crazy things like... We saw coffins, like, shooting down the road, you know, and I was like, whoa, it's like a coffin race. It was because the flood was literally wiping everything out and emptying the graveyards. It was really scary and freaky. And
did you incorporate that into the movie?
No, because I felt it was weird. Even though I'm a horror filmmaker, I still thought it was in bad taste. I was like, you know, I don't want to show that. Those people, you know, there's people in there, you know, and so I kind of felt, for me, it's I just didn't want to cross that line.
So there's a difference between the horrors of that occasionally come up in real life and the horror of the horror movie genre.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I lost a dear friend in 2005, which is when I kind of went on hiatus for films for a while. Because for 7 years I went on hiatus because I lost Dennis Kingsolver at Catacombs. And we grew up together. He was like a brother to me. And he died basically right there in my arms. And it was a horrible, horrible thing. And you do not become desensitized. A lot of people complain that horror will make you desensitized. And I've shot the grossest stuff you can imagine. And it did not affect me in any way like that. It did not desensitize me to the reality of death and the horrible things out there. So I think if you're desensitized, there's something wrong with you. You know what I mean?
For people who haven't seen your movies, I mean, when you say you've shot the grossest stuff, like what?
Oh, my. These movies are kind of these are not mainstream America. These are, you know, at that time, I was lucky because I hit the cusp of the video boom and distributors needed product. And the product was more the low budget, the B movie stuff that is very, you know, as Joe Bob Briggs says, the three B's, blood, breasts and beasts, because we basically hit all the things that the major studios are afraid to touch. The independent guys have to touch it because that's what gets us in the stores. And for me, I was raised at the drive-in and at the indoor, what we now call grindhouses, which was like the old Empire Theater. And they would show, you know, crazy movies all day long. And so that kind of stuff seemed normal to me. And we were always sitting around trying to figure out ways to shock people. And it's kind of like a Bart Simpson thing, though. It wasn't malicious. It was more like, oh, boy, wait till they get a load of this. And we were just having fun with it. And so we would touch on a lot of topics that were taboo for the majors and that, you know, the major studios would never think of because they have, you know, the moral majority to answer to or whatever. And we were the films that people actually bought and took home from the video store. And that's what made the video stores huge at the time was because VHS was the big thing. And we took pride in supplying them with movies that people would want to watch kind of because, you know, everyone says, Even people who poo-poo that kind of thing, oh, no, they're the first ones buying them and taking them home at night. So it was kind of fun.
In the videos, I mean, you've mentioned a lot of different staples of a certain era in movie, not just movie making, but movie watching, like the video store and the grindhouse. Can you tell us a little bit more about these places and how they defined movies for you and for a lot of people?
Well, for me... you know, the grindhouses, as they're called now, because they were movie theaters that would show movies pretty much, they weren't 24 hours, but they were, you know, all day and half the night till maybe midnight or so. And they would show these, not only would they show like mainstream movies once in a while, but they were really needing product and needing to show things that were exploitable because that got people in to see them. And so that's where your B-movies kind of came into play. And a B-movie, the whole terminology for B-movie came from the drive-ins because the A-picture was... A B-movie could be like a Clint Eastwood Western. It didn't have to be something of poor quality. It just happened to be the second movie on the bill. But it turned out that those movies were more popular than maybe the movies they were playing with, which is kind of funny. And the A-pictures were like the studio pictures. Like, okay, Warner Brothers just released this. But at the time, those studios also had... lower budgeted stuff they'd pair them together, or maybe people like Roger Corman would produce a film to get in there on that secondary market. So the problem was we needed to fill screens in this country with product. Movies had become a big deal, and they needed more and more product. So that made room for the independent guys to come in and to do these movies that, again, to compete with the money guys, you'd have to have a hook, or you'd have to have a reason to get butts in the seat, as I've always said. And the reason in this case was the exploitable elements that they'd touch on that Hollywood wouldn't. And that's where, like, the grindhouse became called, the terminology was because they were grinding movies one after another after another after another. So people would just go in, pay a price, and hang out for a while, and then they'd leave when they wanted to. And you could see four or five movies for the same price, which is kind of cool.
And the home video aspect of it, I mean, I was a kid in what was probably like the height of the home video movement. And so I remember being in video stores and seeing the horror film section. I wasn't allowed those movies.
Right.
But I remember that there were these crazy covers of these cardboard boxes, and there were just tons and tons and tons of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this certain look, like the reds of used for blood were like really deep, bright red.
Oh, yeah.
Like, people used to joke about that it was ketchup, but I mean, ketchup even does not, I mean, I don't know what it is. You, I'm sure, do. But I mean, what was that moment? What did the home video and the video store have to do with this moment for horror movies?
It was amazing because suddenly people at home had a choice, not through cable TV or whatever, but they could actually go out and choose the movies they wanted to see. And it turned out a lot of people kind of liked these trashy horror films. And the video stores were full of them because your number one rentals were always like new releases. It might be the latest blockbuster with Dustin Hoffman, or maybe it was, the Batman with Tim Burton's Batman. But then as soon as those kind of things, the secondary highest renters, the ones that were always going, were the horror films. So the new release horror films would fly off the shelves, but also the library horror films. So a lot of times, when the movies were done off the new release wall and you put them into the regular rotation of your library of your store, dramas, not so much, comedies maybe, but horror films always would rent.
So they never get old.
Right. They would never, the rentals on those, every Friday night, the kids would come in or the teenagers or even adults would come in and be, we're going to get this. We got to get this new release. We got to get a scary movie too. And those video boxes were works of art. I mean, really, you'd walk through and they'd pop off those shelves at you. They would jump into your eyes, and you would have to choose from all these. And most of the time you'd get it home and you'd be like, wow, that movie never lived up to the box. But it was just the greatness of discovering that moment, of what it was. And that's where a lot, movies like Evil Dead and all the slasher films like My Bloody Valentine and things, they did okay at the box office, but they did amazing on home video because people suddenly had horror in their living room,
Which is the scariest place for it to be, maybe second
right.
to bedroom or bathroom.
And it was the safest place too. So you could experience your worst fears and your most vivid nightmares in the safety of your living room.
So would you say that that's the appeal of horror movies, what the genre you work in, that there's a sort of safe scare?
I think so. I think there's a part of it has that. A part of it has the fact that I think as human beings, we're always kind of intrigued by the darkness. And in horror films, we can explore that. We can explore ideas that are outside the realm of average. That's why, paranormal is so popular. Like, you watch Destination America, the whole network is basically paranormal shows, for better or worse, some of those. But it's like, because I think our fascination with that realm that we don't know anything about, and I believe that horror films are a safe way to explore it. Plus, it's like a roller coaster ride. Your adrenaline, because your visceral reaction to what you're seeing on the screen, it's kind of it's very much like riding a roller coaster, only without leaving your chair.
I have to imagine that you were a viewer of horror movies before you were a maker of them. How and when, what was going on in your life when you first got into these movies?
I was a child, very young. My first childhood memory is Night of the Living Dead on a double, triple bill, actually, with The Boy Who Cried Werewolf and the movie, it was just called it's about a guy that turned into a snake. And the guy that turned into a snake happened to be Starbuck from Battlestar Galactica. But yes, that was my first childhood memory. And from that point, I was fascinated. And as a child, it was weird because I kind of had a weird, unstable childhood. We were moving a lot, always. And it's really hard to make friends when you're moving all the time.
Yeah, always the new kid.
Yeah, it was always a mess. And you're always trying to fit in. So my friends were like superheroes, like DC and Marvel at the time, which, believe it or not, used to kind of cross over. That was before Disney's hell took over all that corporate nightmare. But it was really neat then. And this was in the 70s. And superheroes and the Universal Monsters and all that stuff. Like, I kind of felt a connection with, like, the Wolfman and Creature from the Black Lagoon and Frankenstein's monster, because they weren't really evil. They were just kind of victims of circumstance. Like, the Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Outsiders.
Yeah, he's hanging out in his backyard, and suddenly all these people are boating through and messing him up. So he didn't do anything wrong. He was just
so
like,
you related
hey.
To, like, the quote-unquote bad guys.
Well, and the funny thing was, I mean, who didn't love Darth Vader? I mean, when Star Wars came out, you wouldn't even think about it if it wasn't for Darth Vader. That's the thing that got everyone. I mean, when you saw the posters, Luke wasn't on them. It was Darth Vader, because that's what it was about. And he turned out to be a misunderstood villain also. So it's kind of neat. And for me, you know, Batman was always my favorite. It still is. But the Universal Monsters just spoke. And I really was into, like, the creature feature and things like that.
What is a creature feature?
That was, like, on the weekends in the 70s. On Saturday nights, you'd have the creature feature. And on Friday nights, you'd have Friday Fright Night. And these were these little horror... Like, that was Channel 5, KC... It was at CBS. They would have the Friday Fright Night. And then on the weekends, we'd have KSHB Channel 41, who... would have the creature feature with Uncle Ed, and all these things were going on, and the Cremation Mortem came in later, but these were in Kansas City, our connection to horror, and they would show all kinds of crazy stuff. I remember seeing Frankenstein's Bloody Terror, and I was like, oh my God, it's the greatest movie of all time. It's pretty not, but I still love it.
What do you think? I mean, do you think that there is a central question that horror movies are asking that interests you?
I don't know if there's a central question. I think I just enjoyed the excitement and the fact that they were shot in a way that didn't resemble other movies. Because nowadays, movies have kind of become homogenized. Like, horror films almost look like other movies, but they usually look bleached out. Like, you know, everything right now has that bleached look, like Saw or whatever. But horror films back then were very colorful, and they had these neat angles, like I've learned they're called Dutch angles. Like, it looked like you were looking at a living comic book a lot of the times.
What do you mean by that?
By Dutch angle?
Yeah, or by, like, what it looked like, that you were looking at a living comic book.
Well, because the angles, you know, it would be off-kilter angles, low angles, high angles, things that you wouldn't see in a normal movie. Like, the lighting would be really extravagant. You'd have all these amazing blues and greens and reds, and things seem to pop. And then these fantastical elements would be going on at the same time, and you'd have werewolves and vampires, and it just seemed really cool to me. I was like, man, it's so neat. It's so outside the realm of normal. And I think as a nerd kid growing up in this situation, it just kind of helped me. It took me out of the reality for an hour and a half while I was watching it. And like I said, it never scared me or anything. I was kind of fascinated with it. Not so much with the killing people, but with just the whole world that it had been creating.
So. The colors, the look, the feel.
Right, right.
So you've said that you're, you know, pre-1993 does not exist to you anymore in your own
much,
filmmaking.
Yeah.
In 1993, you made Zombie Bloodbath, and you've said that this is the first time you, like, really tried to make a good movie.
Right.
And so what was Zombie Bloodbath about? And talk a little bit about the techniques you used in that movie.
Well, it was kind of the first one that we, like I said, we really tried to do something on. It was like an homage to zombie movies that I loved. Not only Romero's Night of the Living Dead or Dawn of the Dead, but also Italian horror films I fell in love with. I saw them, you know, at the drive-in and at the Empire Theater. And Lucio Fulci especially. I just really, something about his films just touched me, his the way he did them. And so I wanted to do something that was kind of an homage to those. So we mixed up, we took like a big mixing bowl and threw in every zombie movie that we loved and just stirred it up and made this plot that really was kind of crazy, but it was cool. I mean,
what was the plot?
There wasn't. All right, a nuclear reactor had melted down in Kansas, or Missouri, whichever. It was right on the border. And
one of those states.
One of those right there Kansas City area states. And so then they covered the whole thing up. They closed it down, covered it up, the government, and they built houses on it, of course. And of course, all of this happened because it was on an ancient burial ground. I mean, you've heard it all before, because we decided to take every cliche known and put it all into this movie. With mixed results, you know, but we were trying, we were having a good time, and that's what it was about.
You've got blood pouring down people's faces, eyes sunken in, organs being ripped out from the inside of people's bodies. The only thing I could compare the organs to, like, what they look like, it looks to me, if I had to guess what you're using, I think bubblegum, like the way bubblegum stretches. I mean, I cannot figure out what, because this isn't using computer graphics, what's the stuff you're using to make that gory stuff happen?
Usually it's foam and latex, and the stuff you see that's stretching like that, we take a flat surface like this table here, and we take a paintbrush and put a very thin layer of latex on it, and we powder it when we peel it off so it doesn't stick to itself, and we score it with, like, you know, an X-Acto knife or whatever, make little holes in it, and that way whenever we go to pull it looks like we're pulling tendons or whatever. It stretches like that. You know, yeah, it's nasty stuff. So that's one of the many things that we use.
We're talking to filmmaker Todd Sheets about his career in the horror movie genre. He's got a new movie, Dreaming Purple Neon. We'll hear about that later, as well as his own personal story, which has had quite a few scares in it as well. I'm Gina Kaufman. Central Standard will return. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Todd Sheets, the Kansas City filmmaker who became really known for his hit Zombie Bloodbath in 1993. He's got a new movie, Dreaming Purple Neon. It's going to premiere tomorrow night at Armor location of the Screenland Theaters. Welcome back, Todd.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We were just looking back on the 1980s and early 1990s as a certain period in filmmaking, but I want to talk to you about your own personal story a little bit more, because you got out of filmmaking for a while, and that you've mentioned it was because of the death of your friend. Who was the friend who died, and what happened?
Dennis Kingsolver, and we were, for about 10 years, I was down at Catacombs, and it turned out to be longer than that. This was...
You worked there?
Yeah. I was part of the crew that was there all year round, and it was a passion, and we worked on that thing. We would usually start right after Thanksgiving and build on it all year until, you know, it got close to, you know, about August, we'd wrap things up and get ready to open for Halloween. And Dennis and I had grown up together in Gracemore, and he was like a brother to me, and there was a horrible accident there in the elevator shaft, and I tell you, it kind of was it for me. It changed me in so many ways, you know.
It might be surprising to people that someone who has worked in horror movies would be taken out of that by an encounter with, you know, a really gruesome tale in real life. What about that experience made you not want to do what you were doing anymore?
I think it was because... it just affected us all so deeply. I mean, we stayed at Catacombs. His parents kept the place going for a few years after that, and then they sold it. I think it was mainly because of the fact that it had become so difficult to make movies in Kansas City anyway. And
why?
It just seemed like the politics of the city and a lot of religious overtones here. It's kind of like the Bible Belt, and a lot of people were making it harder and harder to make the kind of movies I made. And
don't mean to get hung up on this, but how did people make it harder?
Doors were closing. I think it was because of the Baptist church, particularly. I had problems with, like, Pleasant Valley Baptist and some of those guys, but there was a very strong arm deal going on at that time to get horror movies out of the video stores here. Our own, at the time, I think it was John Ashcroft, was saying, well, I'm going to get horror films out of these video stores. I mean, there's a big bunch of BS. And then they were trying to close down all the haunted houses, and we had guys picketing and walking down the road dragging crosses dressed as Jesus. I'm like, I don't think Jesus would be wasting his time hanging out in the bottoms here, guys. It was very frustrating. We had people picketing the Best Buys to get rid of anime movies. It was just stupid. And I was very frustrated with that. I was tired of, because I'm like, you know, none of us are doing anything to worship the devil here. And even if we were, that's our business. It's called America. But that wasn't my intent at all. I was just trying to make horror movies.
And your friend Dennis, had he been in your movies? Had he been one of your collaborators?
He was one of my biggest supporters. He basically gave me the entire sixth floor of the catacombs. He says, you know, Todd, you know, you can have this whole floor. Just do what you want with it. And I turned it into like my studio, and I put all my editing stuff in there. And I practically lived at that building morning, noon, and night. And it was weird because he was truly a gift. When I went to, you know, the funeral and everything, there were so many people, and he touched so many lives. And here's a guy that his passion was this haunted house thing with catacombs. He'd done it since he was a kid. We did it in Gracemore, and he had a great family. I used to say eight is enough, Dennis, because he kept having these amazing children. But Dennis was one of the most kind-hearted, amazing people I've ever met in my life, which is true of many of my friends in the horror industry. I mean, honestly. And but I think his passing hurt me in so many ways that I just didn't feel like doing it anymore. I didn't feel like doing anything. Right. And so I just kind of, but then speaking of heart, I later had a heart attack, which I don't even know why. I don't drink or do drugs. I've never smoked. I'm just a nerd. But I had a genetic issue, and I had a heart attack, and I needed quadruple bypass surgery. And that's when I realized, you know, before that I'd been missing.
This was just a few years ago, right?
Yeah, this was in 2012. And I'd already kind of been planning a comeback because I missed making movies so bad. And I said, well, if I can't do it here, I'll do it somewhere else. And so I'd already been working on a script, and I finished that script in the hospital. I was in the hospital 31 days. I didn't think I was ever getting out of there. I thought I was going to die in there. But I did make myself a promise. If I do get out of here, I'm getting back to what I love. I'm going to make horror movies. And that's when I finished writing House of Forbidden Secrets, which was our 2013 release.
And people are calling your new movie, Dreaming Purple Neon, a follow-up to that. But there's a line very early on in House of Forbidden Secrets that seems to sort of like set the stage for that movie in some ways. And I'm curious about what this phrase means to you. The line is, keep in mind that every religion has its own form of demon or evil spirit. I think there has to be something to it.
In the context of House of Forbidden Secrets, that I wrote that line, and it was because if you go through history of different religions, and this, you know, I was very much into Asian philosophy, and I learned a lot about the Asian religions. Every religion I've looked for has their own version of demons. I mean, the jinn, you know, for the Middle Eastern, and the Asians had too many to name. They have so many hells, but it's really exciting because you see the similarities between every country and their legends and mythology and their religion, and all of them have different kind of demons or evil spirits, and they all, so that's kind of what that's talking about, because she's saying they have to exist or they wouldn't be in every single philosophy and religion. There has to be something to it.
When she says that, I mean, is she basically speaking your thoughts on this subject?
Not exactly, but when I write a script, I don't necessarily put completely, like, I don't pour my own philosophy into it. But what I do is I raise questions. So it's like, okay, well, think about this. And I look at things like with an open mind. So I'm saying, well, who's to say it's not real? Who's to say ghosts don't exist? Who's to say evil spirits aren't real? And that's basically what she's saying.
When the press release for your new movie, Dreaming Purple Neon, says this is horror like we all love, like we all grew up with, in the grindhouses, drive-in theaters, and multiplexes of yesterday. And I mean, it doesn't have computer graphics taking care of the visual effects, but it does look a lot more polished. You can tell that it's made in a different era. Can you talk about your approach to filmmaking now and whether how it's the same as where you started and maybe where some tools of the modern filmmaking era have found their way in?
Well, I think there's pros and cons. Filmmaking has become easier thanks to the digital age. I mean, we can edit now. I mean, I remember in the old days, editing was a nightmare. It was so difficult to get things edited and how I had to do it. And it was primitive and barbaric, really. Now we can bring the footage in and we have all this freedom with these amazing editing programs. They're expensive, but they're worth it. I mean, it's basically the whole world at your fingertips. That is great. On the plus side, people with a vision can go out now and become filmmakers. On the negative side, everyone with a cell phone thinks they're Scorsese. You know, it's flooded the market with stuff that's really hurt distribution for a lot of people. And on top of that, it's also created this YouTube generation, which it's all of us like to watch YouTube once in a while. But it's like there's no attention span anymore. It's like 30 seconds and suddenly that's it. So it's very frustrating from that regard. But on the plus side, there are people out there that are brilliant filmmakers that don't have the money. And you used to have so much money to do this. And now you can, a few thousand dollars, and you can make it look like you've spent a lot of money if you put enough work into it. Like Dream Purple Neon, I self-financed the whole movie because I got tired of dealing with executive producers who were very much control freaks. So, and on House Forbidden Secrets, which I'm extremely proud of the film, I had an executive producer issue, which was a lot of controlling and a lot of fighting and things. So it was difficult.
Before we go, I mean, we have just in a few seconds, really. How would you like to tease out the big reveal tomorrow, the Dreaming Purple Neon? What's it about? What are people going to see?
Well, you kind of described it earlier. It's a kind of a return to old school. It's done in a modern way, refreshing, a modern approach to horror. But there's a lot of things in this film that are very nostalgic and will remind you of the glory days. We got the splatter film kind of mentality going. It's gross. I'm not going to kid. We've pushed every button known to man on this one. So the last one, you know, is more of a, you know, House Forbidden Secrets. It's been in like 84 film festivals, so it was more mainstream. And this was kind of a return to the old days. So,
okay. Well, Todd Sheets, thank you for your time and welcome back to filmmaking.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Todd's new movie, Dreaming Purple Neon, premieres tomorrow night at Screenland Armor, and the screening begins at 9. Up next, Lizards, and our Story of a Song series brings us a tune called White Girls. I'm Gina Kaufman. Back in a minute. Last year, Kansas City singer Rachel Mallon was recovering from a failed relationship, a relationship she felt was hijacked by a certain kind of girl. She started churning out lyrics, but it wasn't until she got a job at a clothing store that she really figured out what she wanted to say. Here's Rachel Mallon telling us how she strummed the song White Girls into existence.
Hold on, give me one second. You were jamming. It was at the time where I wanted things to sound kind of like old school, kind of like, you know, your 60s, Buddy Holly, bull crap. And just that the way that it's like plucked is like do 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 do. We were kind of drawing from like the riffs of old music. We went for very shiny guitar tones, but kind of still under that layer of like vinyl fuzz you hear in old music. This time last year was working like 8 to 9 hour days, 5 days a week at Forever 21. I think there was one, I wasn't even working out front this day. I think I was restocking leggings. And this lady, She wasn't a lady. She was a girl. She freaked out. She couldn't get, like, a return on her leggings that, like, ripped the second day she owned them. But, dude, like, Forever 21. Like, it's, you're paying $3 for a pair of leggings made in China. If we're being honest here, I am just the slave worker in the back. Don't yell at me about it. Like, I can't control your return. There is a breaking point you reach, I think, just as a human being, when you have to deal with a lot of the same kind of people who are come from a very, like, privileged background. I spent a lot of the time in the back room because, like, holidays were coming up and we were getting a lot of shipments. When I did have to go out front and have interactions with customers, I would just, like, reel the line, God save the white girls, in my head. And I had to deal with a lot of white girls. Woo! I'm definitely, yes. I'm Caucasian female. I mean, like, it depends what your definition of white girl is. There's a lot of jokes about white girls in the way of, like, Starbucks and Uggs. And I'm gonna be honest, I love pumpkin spice lattes. I'm never gonna deny that. So maybe I can relate to them. What I hope for the white girl is a feeling of, like, independence and a feeling of, like, going out into the world and seeing that, like, not everybody is set up with the same situation and being able to empathize. I don't know. The white girl might get hitched to the doctor. My ultimate goal in life to, like, walk into an establishment and your song is playing, but if that ever happened at Forever 21, I would be able to die after that. Like, that would be the greatest oxymoron. All of it's kind of like satirical, but also kind of for real, like, serious. And it comes from, like, stuff that's painful, but I'm just a sarcastic bitch.
That was Rachel Mallon of the band Rachel Mallon and the Wild Type with the story of a song called White Girls. The story was produced by KCUR's Andrea Tudhope. Now we're joined by Richard Glore. He's a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at KU, and his research on lizards has led him to believe that our understanding of which animals are in the same species has been maybe not quite right. Hi, Richard.
Hello. Pleasure to be here.
We'll get into the discoveries about species shortly, but let's start with lizards. How did you get into lizards? And I mean, like, really into lizards.
Well, there's not an easy answer to that because I've been interested in lizards for as long as I can remember. I think most of us that are in this field that I work in, herpetology and biodiversity more generally, we're just fascinated by organisms and biodiversity. And so in many cases, we've just been doing it for our whole lives and just kind of transitioned from kids who are flipping over logs and finding frogs to people that are working in molecular genetic laboratories discovering new species.
What interested you when you began observing lizards in the Dominican Republic? Because it sounds like that's where you started, and you started there very young. But I'm curious about what intrigued you about these lizards in particular.
Yeah, I did start there kind of young. We have some great programs for undergraduates to do research through the National Science Foundation. I was able to travel to the Dominican Republic for the first time when I was 19. And one of the things that fascinated me about the lizard that I still study today is as a 19-year-old, I was doing some surveys in a national park. And I saw that if I just walked a couple of kilometers, the appearance of these lizards completely changed. And in particular, they have this flap of skin on their throat called the dewlap that they extend. It's colorful. They use it to display to potential mates and rivals.
Is it the thing that looks kind of like an Adam's apple, but just huge?
It kind of looks like an Adam's apple, but it's not actually like an apple. It's more like a flag. So it's just a flap of skin that they have a ligament that they can extend like a, they literally signal like a flag.
Off of their necks.
Yes, yes, it's on their neck. You may have seen them, big iguanas will have dewlaps. There's lots of lizards that have these, but anoles really have developed them to a very fine degree where they have very species-specific colors and patterns as well as displays that they use to show these dewlaps to one another.
So take me through your mental process as you begin to zoom in on these particular lizards in this particular place with this particular neck flap.
Well, initially, as a young student, I just saw this as a curiosity. I thought, why do they have orange dewlaps here? And then I get on a boat and I go 2 kilometers away and they have yellow dewlaps. And I thought, well, doesn't this defy or cause problems with mating? If you have the wrong color dewlap, maybe you're not recognizing your mates. And I've spent a good part of my career trying to answer that question. Why do they have different dewlap colors in these different localities that are so nearby?
And so the identifying mates thing, is that a big deal? Because of we've defined a species as if you're in the same species, you can create offspring that are also fertile.
Yes, exactly. That's one of the big criteria that people use to define species. Biologists have argued for a long time about what even a species is. So how do we go out in nature and identify species? And it turns out that the big part of the problem is that species are one of these things that they form continuously and kind of drawing a line. Think about it like, how do we decide when a human is an adult? Is it when they hit puberty? Is it when they get a driver's license? Is it when they move out of home? So we can argue about where exactly we draw that line, but everyone agrees that humans form adults. And species are kind of the same thing. So for many, many decades, we've had this challenge of just how do we recognize species in nature?
And so you think that your lizards in the Dominican Republic complicate that?
I think they don't complicate it. They add this fascinating dimension of being able to study how species is occurring through actual investigation of organisms in nature. So the advantage of seeing these populations that seem very similar, except for, say, one trait like the dewlap, is that these seem like young species. And for previous generations of systematists, this was seen as a challenge and a complication.
So like young separate species.
Yeah, so species that are on their way to becoming new species, but may not be as deeply divergent as, say, a horse and a donkey are. This is the famous example of if we mate a horse and a donkey, we know they're different species because we get sterile offspring when we cross them. There are lots of species that just haven't gotten that far in the process. Speciation takes millions of years. And that's what these lizards that I study makes them so fascinating for me, is that we can investigate this process by which new species are forming.
What have you found as you've investigated that? I mean, I don't know how old you are now. You seem significantly older than 19, though not quote unquote old.
Thanks. It's good not to look like I'm 19. Myself and other folks in speciation research have made a number of really exciting discoveries recently. And one of these is that once we use molecular data, once we get data about our genomes and the genomes of organisms, it turns out there's a lot of species out there that we didn't see before. So think about an example where if I put 4 glasses of soda in front of you, let's say I put a root beer and a Coke and a 7-Up and an orange Fanta, and I say, how many different kinds of soda are there? You might say 3. There's 2 brown ones, a clear one, and an orange one. And then I say, okay, well, now taste the sodas. And you taste them and say, holy cow, these 2 brown ones are totally different from one another. Root beer is completely different tasting than Coke. That ability to taste the sodas for you is kind of like the insight that we're getting from molecular genetic data. It's a whole nother layer of insight on what a species is and how they differ from one another. And some species we just can't see with our eyes. We can't distinguish them easily by looking at them. We need some other form of information.
So does science have an agreement on how different 2 species need to be on a molecular level? Because I have really always just heard this definition about you mate, you create fertile offspring. You're the same species, you mate, you don't create fertile offspring. Sorry, no dice.
Yeah, and I think that that's an attitude that a lot of people have. And that's what you learn in biology, intro bio. We teach this, it's called the biological species concept. If things can't cross with one another, they're different species. If they can cross, they're not different species. And what I always like to ask my students in when I teach herpetology, for example, I'll say, hey, how do we describe species? And they'll give me the answer. And then I'll show them a description of a new species. And I'll say, show me the part of this paper where somebody crossed different species to ask if they're interfertile or not. No one ever does that. So that's really just a criterion that is kind of idealistic and philosophical and maybe theoretical, but it can rarely be used in nature. And moreover, one of the big insights we're getting from new genomic research is that lots of young species in nature are still crossing. There's still a relatively low degree of interfertility, and that can be very useful to a species.
How?
So this is it's a kind of a difficult concept to explain, but it's one of the greatest insights we derive from genomic data, which is parts of the genome can move between species and some parts can't. So to give a kind of cultural analogy, think about there's 1 million people in Kansas City. And suppose
I think there are 2 million.
2 million. Okay, let's give Kansas City 2 million. And let's not argue about how many are in St. Louis, but let's say there's 2 million in St. Louis too.
Okay, let's just say that.
And let's say there's people moving back and forth between Kansas City and St. Louis all the time. But let's imagine that, let's say 10% of each population, 200,000 in Kansas City, 200,000 in St. Louis, are huge baseball fans. Those folks in Kansas City are Royals fans. Those in St. Louis are Cardinals fans. As long as those people are there, the city, the culture of the city, assumes this fandom of the Royals or the Cardinals. And as long as those people don't move that much between the two cities, we're still going to maintain this distinctness. And those are like the parts of the genome that maintain species distinctness in the face of gene flow. And the advantage of that for a species, just like for a city, if you're Kansas City and you want some more people that are good computer programmers, maybe you steal some from St. Louis. Or if St. Louis needs some folks that are Masons, maybe they'll steal some from Kansas City.
But the ones from Kansas City need to become Cardinals fans, and the ones from St. Louis need to become Royals fans?
No, as long as analogy may break down. But the basic point is that as long as we have this core group of people that define the culture of Kansas City and St. Louis as distinct, we can maintain this distinction in spite of a lot of sharing happening. And that's what happens with genomes. We have parts of the genome that maintain the distinctness between species, whereas other parts of the genome may be shared between species.
So this is how we are close relatives of fruit flies, even though we would not recognize them or invite them to, like, dinner.
Well, we're rather distantly related from fruit flies, and I don't know if they'd make a great dinner companion, but we certainly have a lot to learn from fruit flies. And fruit flies are a major area of research in speciation because we could dissect this precise genetic basis. And this insight that I'm talking about, which parts of the genome are moving between populations, was derived initially from work that was done in the laboratory with fruit flies. And what my research is trying to do, and a lot of other researchers now, is trying to combine that insight from detailed genetic experiments in laboratory organisms with insight from animals in nature that are actually undergoing this process of speciation.
So in the Dominican Republic, you are exploring all of these really heady ideas by looking at lizards. Can you take me to one of these, like, observation moments? Because you do your work in the field, and I'm curious, like, yeah, take me there with you. Where are you going? What are you doing? What are you looking at?
Well, we have kind of two exciting things that will happen in the field. One of those is, which is much rarer than the other, is when we actually find a new species. And so biologists will have occasionally moments in the field where you see a new organism and you just immediately know that it's new and different. And that can't be rivaled among biologists, I think, the excitement of discovering a wholly new species. And this has happened recently in the Dominican Republic. We've discovered a giant new lizard in a very well-explored area in a very unusual kind of forest that just wasn't found before because it's incredibly hard to find.
What does it look like?
It looks like lichen. It looks like a gray twig covered with lichen. It's beautiful.
Okay, well, that is unfortunately all the time we have for this morning's conversations on KCUR's Central Standard. Richard Glore with KU's Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. Good luck to you as you continue to change the way we think about species and look at your beautiful lizards in the Dominican Republic.
Thanks, Gina. It's great to be here.
And that's a wrap for today's Central Standard. Thanks for tuning in. We've talked about a local horror movie maker, a new species of lizard, and a song by a local band. All of those conversations will be online at kcur.org/centralstandard by the end of the day. If you missed yesterday's show about a new arts grant for the West Bottoms and concerns about gentrification in the neighborhood, you'll find that online too. There's been a lively conversation. You can join in on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Tomorrow is a food show. We'll hear about the business side of those pumpkin and apple orchards families are visiting this time of year, plus the best desserts in town. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope, with help from interns Raven Brooks and Aaron Pelish. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.